The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Take the International Committee of the Red Cross. That organization was established in 1863 after a Swiss businessman by the name of Henri Dunant walked or passed or rode his horse by the battlefield of Solferino. And he saw the thousands of wounded soldiers on the battlefield anguishing with wounds that were not cared for. And the whole raison d'être behind the establishment of the ICRC and the evolution of the humanitarian conventions thereafter was precisely with the thought that once a person is wounded, they are wounded. And once they no longer pose a threat to you, they're just a human being. And if you start tweaking and cutting at this principle, then you are in a slippery slope.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 12, 2015. That was Gabriella Blum, a professor of law at Harvard University and contributing editor to Lawfare. On this week's Lawfare Podcast, Ben sat down with Professor Blum and Dustin Lewis, a senior researcher at Harvard Law School's Program on International Law and Armed Conflict, to discuss their new report, which was co-authored by Naz Modirzadeh, on whether we should consider medical care a form of illegitimate support to terrorists. Their argument, no, as IHL lays down extensive protections for medical care, which in many instances should also constrain domestic material support cases. Yet the authors make clear there's more to be done, and there are gaps and weaknesses in the protections afforded by IHL itself. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 138, A Band-Aid for a Bomber, Is Medical Assistance to Terrorists Protected Under International Humanitarian Law?
Okay, let's start with an overview of this report. What does it cover, and why did you guys take on this particular subject?
So the way this started is really we got questions and expressions of concern from humanitarian organizations doing work in Syria about being targeted, even when these humanitarian organizations were basically just providing medical care for wounded people, both combatants and non-combatants, on the battlefield. And at first it seemed like a very straightforward question and answer, that it was obvious that that is illegal and shouldn't happen. The more we started digging into it, the more we found that while the particular question of targeting people who are considered authorized medical providers is very clear, actually the question of the status of medical providers on the battlefield is much more complicated under international law, and that the answers are far less straightforward than what one might expect or wish for. So that prompted us to do a comprehensive and comparative study, I think first of its kind, in thinking about all the issues that pertain to medical care on the battlefield from the particular perspective of counterterrorism measures. And it turned out that once you invoke the counterterrorism paradigm, that gives you sort of an excuse to ratchet down or at least not fully comply with the spirit of the law in terms of the protections you give either to those who are wounded or those who provide care for them.
Okay, so let's unpack that. First of all, are we talking here about narrowly about U.S., the possibility of U.S. prosecution of medical providers under material support laws, or is it a larger set of problems and concerns involving a wider array of statutes and a larger array of countries?
It's certainly the latter. So for us, what we think about it as two sets of addressees, if you want. It's the governments who design and implement counterterrorism measures. That includes the government of the United States, but also other governments around the world, and the degree to which they take seriously the immunity or the desired immunity for medical care providers, and that certainly covers the question of medical support or material support statutes in the context of medical care. But it's also the international sphere, including the Security Council itself, that it turns out that when the Security Council devises counterterrorism policies that purportedly bind the entire international community, not only are they not careful enough to grant immunity to medical providers, they actually cite medical support as an illegal means of support and grounds for sanctions against those who provide medical treatment.
Okay, so let's back up and talk about what the supposed regime is and what the effective loopholes are in that regime once you invoke the counterterrorism paradigm.
When it comes to the different level of IHL obligations for different states, one of the key things we found was on non-punishment of medical providers. This is a provision in two really important treaties from the 1970s, Additional Protocol 1 for international armed conflicts and an Additional Protocol 2 for non-international armed conflicts, or at least certain non-international armed conflicts. When you look at Colombia, Peru, and the United States, each of these states has recognized a different type of obligation that it has under IHL when read in tandem with their counterterrorism laws. So under Colombia, of course, is a six-decade-long armed conflict with the FARC, and they, up until 1994, considered that the crime of rebellion, which is one of their counterterrorism provisions, it's read jointly with, you know, treason alongside of counterterrorism, that would have included medical support. But when Colombia became a party to Additional Protocol 2, so this non-international armed conflict treaty, all of a sudden no longer could Colombia punish the medical providers for the FARC, at least immediate triage. Similarly, Peru had obligations under Additional Protocol 2, but unlike Colombia, Peru just never recognized them in its non-international armed conflict during the 1980s and 1990s with the Shining Path and other organized armed groups. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the United States, which hasn't contracted into any of these obligations in Additional Protocol 1 or 2, so it doesn't recognize any IHL-related obligations concerning non-punishment of medical providers when it comes to their counterterrorism laws. This is one of the only provisions in the Law of War Manual where the U.S. does not incorporate an Additional Protocol 2 medical care provision. I think it's actually the only one. And then when you see that further in the Law of War Manual that came out in June, the U.S. government says that states may penalize people for providing medical care, providing material support to terrorists, and then you know U.S. law is that medical care and assistance can be considered material support, all of a sudden you realize that between Colombia and the United States, there's huge daylight about what they consider to be the different IHL obligations when read in tandem with their counterterrorism laws.
So realistically, if you are a doctor operating in Syria, to go back to your original issue that caused you to get involved in this, if you're a doctor providing medical assistance to the Syrian rebels, and you're kind of aware that, you know, there are Syrian rebels who are on the terrorist list and there are Syrian rebels who aren't, and you're providing care on a sort of whoever comes basis, what realistic jeopardy do you have under, from whom?
So my first jeopardy is from the Syrian forces that are going to target me. And the second...
And is that legal under IHL?
No, it won't. It won't be legal. But here's our concern. So it wouldn't be legal to target any civilian who doesn't participate in the hostilities. The question is whether, from the Syrian government perspective, my provision of medical care crosses that line. And since I don't know which laws operate in Syria, I don't know, but it's totally possible. And here is the real concern. So for the Syrian government, I'm providing material support or maybe even participating in the hostilities simply by providing medical care. Then I travel to the United States. I could stand trial for providing material support to terrorists through the provision of medical care. I'm pretty certain I'll never be targeted because of my provision of medical care, but I could stand trial. So here was our real concern. By the way, the U.S. material support statute makes a distinction between administering medicine and providing any other medical treatment, meaning if I give somebody Tylenol, that's okay, but if I dress their wound, it's not okay. It takes legal ingenuity to figure out what the rationale of this distinction, but we'll put this aside. So I could stand trial in the United States. And this was a real concern. We don't think that punishing somebody and targeting them on the battlefield is the same. But once you chip into the idea that medical care providers should just be immune from the ambit of the conflict, including any counterterrorism measures, then you start chipping in, and one country limits it in one way, and the other country goes further and actually targets these people. And our real concern and motivation behind this report was not to draw direct comparisons, but to say, here is the risk you're running in eroding the general protections for medical care providers.
And where are the – what if your hypothetical doctor escaping Syrian barrel bombs goes to Europe? Is there any kind of European consensus about what immunity means?
Sure. So right now there's no documented consensus because there's no cases that have been instituted or legal proceedings that have been instituted yet. But the Guardian's reported that in the United Kingdom, they're actively considering whether or not to institute legal criminal proceedings against a number of UK citizens, as well as Canadians, and I believe there's an American, who went to Syria from Sudan, they're medical students, for the purpose of providing medical assistance in ISIS-held territory. And so there's a question whether once they get back into the United Kingdom, they'll be stopped at the border and put in handcuffs, or if they'll not be. And it's unclear from the public reporting on it what exactly the UK authorities are doing. It seems like they're actively considering this. And then similarly, the Australian authorities are considering whether or not to penalize a young doctor who went to Syria, again, to provide medical assistance in ISIS-held territory to the civilian population as well as to the out-of-the-fight ISIS fighters, if he ever comes back into Australia. And then, of course, even more importantly in some respects, the U.S. and Australia have already taken steps to preclude people from going to those conflict zones in the first place before they could even provide that medical care, impartially or not. And, of course, IHL, so far as we can tell, doesn't in any way actually regulate states' ability to preclude their citizens from traveling across international frontiers to go to a conflict zone to provide that medical care itself, even if it's only to a civilian population.
So this idea that and just to clarify, I take it that if we limit this to international armed conflicts between signatory militaries, there is a broad consensus on a much broader conception of immunity.
That's right.
Absolutely, yes. And U.S. members of the armed forces are trained themselves to provide medical care to wounded combatants on the battlefield.
So in other words, go ahead.
I was just going to say, since 1949, it has been a rule in all international armed conflicts for any contracting state for Geneva Convention 1, which is universal now, universally applicable, that no state may convict anyone, whether or not they're a military medical personnel or anybody else, who nurses the wounded, whether it's enemy or ally. So in international armed conflicts, it's very, very robust protections for this.
And I take it no distinction between administering medicine and, say, applying a bandage?
Not under IHL. So IHL is very clear in this, that it's any medical assistance. So it's nursing the wounded in any way.
Gotcha. So the distinction here is really a distinction between how you handle people who are providing medical care to enemy forces in sort of terrorism context or insurgency context, and where there's no consensus, and then versus state-to-state conflict where there's a very strong consensus. Is that fair?
So there are two fault lines. One is the distinction between, are you classifying the conflict as an international armed conflict versus a non-international armed conflict? And IHL, as we know, is generally more constricted in NIACs, the non-international armed conflict. So that's one fault line. Another fault line, as Dustin mentioned before, is whether the particular state in question has or has not ratified the additional protocols from 1977, which add to the gamut of laws that apply to non-international armed conflict beyond the one provision from the 1949 Geneva Conventions, Common Article 3, which is, for the United States purposes, the only provision they consider as conventional source of law that regulates international armed conflicts apart from any customary obligations.
Okay, so I am going to put myself in the shoes of a counterterrorism hardline skeptic who says, okay, I understand the battlefield humanitarian need for in state-to-state conflict to care for each other's wounded. There's a there's a mutual interest argument for that, as well as to allow each state to take care of its own people, but in asymmetric conflict where you're not really recognizing the right of the other side to field a force in the first place, and you forbid all other forms of assistance to that force. You forbid them to give them money. You forbid to volunteer your personnel. You forbid the provision of goods, of armaments, of anything. Why should you exempt the provision, the doctor who wants to go over and help ISIS, any more than you should exempt the food trucks that, you know, would want to supply ISIS? You could make a humanitarian argument for that too. What is so different about the provision of medical care that there should be a particularly strong exemption from the general propriety of forbidding provision of aid to enemy forces in this context?
So I guess I have an answer that's on three different levels. We'll call it the humanitarian, the legal, and the strategic. So on the humanitarian level, take the International Committee of the Red Cross. That organization was established in 1863 after a Swiss businessman by the name of Henri Dunant walked or passed or rode his horse by the battlefield of Solferino. And he saw the thousands of wounded soldiers on the battlefield anguishing with wounds that were not cared for. And the whole raison d'etre behind the establishment of the ICRC and the evolution of the humanitarian conventions thereafter was precisely with the thought that once a person is wounded, they are wounded. And once they no longer pose a threat to you, they're just a human being. And if you start tweaking and cutting at this principle, then you are in a slippery slope. And you are risking somebody else taking that rationale to the very extreme and saying, since it's support, you know, it's support like financing. It's support like providing weapons, exactly in the same logic you offered. And then we just drop the principle altogether. Because those distinctions, you know, you draw them in one place and I draw them in another. All of life is a line drawing exercise, but this in particular principle, it's really dangerous and it really has no rationale. So which brings me to the legal point. Yes, we make a lot of allowances in asymmetrical conflict for states to do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do in traditional international armed conflicts. But there is a limit to that as well. So there are certain things that we don't think we would do. For instance, if somebody is wounded or incapacitated on the battlefield, or in the legal term, an hors de combat, we don't believe you can go up to them and just shoot them. Now the question is, why not? They're a terrorist, they're not a lawful combatant. Why can't we just shoot wounded people on the battlefield? And the general sentiment is that still we're talking about human beings, and once somebody is wounded and incapacitated, you don't just execute them on the battlefield. You can capture them, you can detain them, but you don't kill them. So even this concept of asymmetrical conflict with people who don't care about the laws of war, have no respect for it, we still think we are bound by certain obligations that are generic, that are universal, that apply regardless of how you classify your conflict or against whom you're fighting. And the last point is really the strategic. The world spends trillions of dollars in counterterrorism efforts, and this country alone spends trillions of dollars in counterterrorism efforts. Is it really necessary to go after people who provide medical care? In some ways, it's not nice to say, but it's almost embarrassing that if with all this investment, in intelligence, in technology, in resources, in all the efforts that we're investing in this, the people you ultimately are able to, you know, handle are people who go to be an on-call doctor for Al-Qaeda. That doesn't seem to me an incredibly successful strategy.
And is that so I entirely agree with you on the latter point. My question is, to what extent is this a theoretical problem, the doctor who is operating in the combat zone has some theoretical liability, and to what extent is it an actual problem? Are these people in fact being prosecuted in this or other countries?
Sure. So in the United States, there's been prosecutions, or at least the institution of criminal legal proceedings. Some have been pleaded out, some have gone to trial, for people who have been accused of providing material support through various forms of medical assistance to designated foreign terrorist organizations, especially Al-Qaeda and its associated forces. There are very few of these prosecutions. There are not that many to go off of. One was not for a medical, not for a doctor, but is actually for a Canadian who was accused of providing material support by teaching nurses to read English medicine labels in Afghanistan, who would then provide medical aid and assistance to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. The more sort of on-point case is this quote-unquote on-call doctor who was accused and convicted of providing or attempting to provide medical assistance to Al-Qaeda the next time that doctor went to Saudi Arabia. He was in Brooklyn at the time. He gave his phone number to an undercover FBI agent. This sustained a conviction and 12-year imprisonment for providing, attempting to provide medical assistance. But it's not common within the United States jurisdiction to go after these cases. There's some unreported cases in the immigration context where somebody couldn't immigrate to the United States because they provided medical assistance as material support in places like Nepal, where there's, you know, counterterrorism, where there's listed terrorist organizations. And even if you did that under duress or some circumstances, there might not be an exception to that. And then there's institution of these proceedings. In Peru, there were many doctors, probably close to 10 or a dozen or maybe more, depending on how many reported cases you can find. In that conflict in Colombia before 1944, there were a number. But there aren't a lot of institution of these legal proceedings within the U.S. jurisdiction.
And then the question is, it's good that there are not many prosecutions. The question is, are there chilling effects of having this statute around and knowing that there have been prosecutions? By the way, in both these prosecutions in the United States, no IHL claims were made on either side of the discussion, either the prosecution or the defense. No one raised international law arguments.
It was purely argued on the basis of what the medicine exemption in the material support
exactly,
statute.
The domestic statute itself, right, without any reference to international law. And again, we have to also remember the transnational or international level, like the UN Sanctions Committee, that, again, if they don't take this into account, if they're not more careful in articulating criteria for the imposition of sanctions, they invite more of these measures by essentially every country around the world. So we're worried not just about the one or two or handful prosecutions, but about the broader chilling effects of what these measures may end up inducing in terms of individual states' policies in the international system policy. And again, the slippery slope concern about, you know, in our case, it's a material support statute. Other countries can take it to more extreme measures.
Sure, and just piggybacking off of that very quickly, it's striking when you read Syria's submissions to UN bodies and to the Human Rights Council, for instance, where they're trying to respond to these claims that they're unlawfully arresting, detaining, targeting medical care providers in the armed conflict in that country. But in their submissions, Syria is using very similar rationales to the ones that the Security Council adopts and the ones that the U.S. and other countries adopt as well at the most basic level, which is that medical assistance is impermissible support to designated terrorist organizations. And once that rationale is in place, it supplants the underlying rationale of IHL, which since 1864 has just said partial medical care to people who are no longer fighting is just above the conflict. This is something that's untouchable.
So what's the solution? What's distill your policy recommendations for our listeners.
So there are long-term comprehensive solutions that are going to take a very long time to get, and their political feasibility is unclear. And that would be just to change IHL, right, to change the laws that wouldn't distinguish anymore, so as not to distinguish anymore between international armed conflicts or non-international armed conflicts, or make it clear that it's not a picking and choosing, that every state around the world is or should be bound by similar rules in every conflict. That's going to take a very long while, if at all. The interim solution is our urging of the domestic, various domestic governments who develop and employ counterterrorism measures to think about this issue and to really weigh seriously whether this is a necessary or essential tool in their toolbox of counterterrorism strategies, or they can just decide, even as a matter of policy, even if you don't think the law obligates you, as a matter of policy, prosecutorial discretion, you are not going after people for merely providing medical care on the battlefield. And again, the other level is the Security Council or other international institutions. Again, as a matter of policy, leave that out. Don't touch these people. There is enough to do. There are enough targets. There are enough people involved. There are enough efforts that one can make on the battlefield and in counterterrorism. Leave that sphere alone.
Gabby, Dustin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.